Welcome to the Syrian Civil War Podcast, a podcast to inform and summarize the events in the conflict in Syria and Iraq to a world that, in many ways, has lost interest. Welcome to the Syrian Civil War Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gentry, Middle Eastern political science student at Appalachian State University. Apologies, by the way, for the delay. I've been away with school and break, but the regularly scheduled bi-weekly episodes will continue, with our new release date being Sundays. In this episode, we will take a look at the Battle of Aleppo, and look at the root cause of the rebel collapse. Then we'll look at the offensive towards Raqqa, the Battle of Deir ez-Zor, the Battle of Palmyra, and the Turkish offensive towards Al-Bab that still, well, has gone nowhere. And our future today will be a discussion on the past, present, and future of Harar al-Sham. All right, first off, we're going to look at the Battle of Aleppo.
Now the Syrian flag is flying again, marking an end of years of fighting for the city. It's not the end of the country's civil war, but it's a triumph for its president. He recorded this message on Thursday, saying, after liberating Aleppo, we can say that not only the Syrian situation, but also the regional and international situation is different. Here, Aleppo converted time into history.
The Eastern Aleppo had been a center for the Syrian opposition since 2012, and after 4 years of fighting, the Syrian opposition lost most of its control of the city and suffered a significant blow. President Assad hailed this as history being made, and despite such a large loss for the opposition, it comes as no surprise. The opposition has been plagued with factionalism as well as been overly demoralized, outgunned, and outbombed for a long time. The rebels managed to hold to their position and ground until November 26th when Hananeo collapsed. Within a day, the rebel lines collapsed en masse, allowing the government to quickly capture Jabr al-Badr al-Hamra in Baladin. The complete failure of the rebel lines continued, and by November 28th, the entire northeastern segment fell. The decimated rebels attempted to hold their ground, but the remaining pockets of resistance were swallowed up in the remaining 2 weeks. The failure to defend the Ramusa corridor back in the offensive in the summer was pivotal in the loss of the eastern portion of the city. There are several important reasons for their inability to defend this corridor, which has led to the subsequent collapse of the pocket. The first and primary reason, though, is rebel infighting. Inter-rebel conflict is not unique to Aleppo, nor is it new to the Syrian opposition in general. Shortly after the rebellion began in 2013, the New York Times reported how factional infighting was undermining rebel efforts. That exact same factional infighting has been going on for the last 3 years. Even in this past year, rebel conflict has allowed for significant government gains in other portions of Syria, like in April, the rebel coalition Jabhat Fateh al-Sham and Falak al-Rama were attacking Jaish al-Islam in East Ghouta. This infighting left 700 fighters dead and crippled rebel efforts to impede government advances in the city. The rebels in Aleppo have been plagued with similar issues. Infighting crippled their inability to launch any kind of sustained counterattacks during the last year. During their attempts to break the siege in November, a member of Fatah Halab told the media that the Fasikim Union rebels were supposed to launch an offensive from Saladin towards Ar al-Sabaga. However, a day prior to the operation, Nour al-Zinki and Abu Amra attacked Fasikim, arrested their commanders, as well as a dozen fighters. In response, Fasikim opened fire. There was a conflict in the next couple days, but Fasikim Union no longer exists because of this infighting. Because of this, their push towards Ar al-Sabaga, which was one of the vital prongs of the rebel counterattack, didn't happen, and the government was able to concentrate its forces on the brunt of the rebel push and crush the counterattack. Another incident happened in the north, in Azaz, when Harar al-Sham was pitted against the Levant front. Accusing them of acting like gangs, Harar al-Sham seized their checkpoints, and there was, 38 were left dead because of this fighting. The other major cause of the collapse, though, was the bombing campaign by the Russian Syrian air forces. Combined with the Assad administration's starvation tactics, these brought the rebel-controlled portion of the city to its knees. The bombing campaign began in November 2015, and for the next year, Russian bombers filled the skies of Aleppo, providing aid for the Syrian government. The Russian air support has been essential to the SAA's success in turning the tide in Aleppo. Because of the bombs not only just killed the fighters, but they also assisted the starvation tactics that are being used. So the idea of the starvation tactics is that you deprive a besieged region of supplies, and then the people inside the city are left with the choice of starving or opposing their own fighters.
At least 28 people have died from starvation. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling it a war crime.
Let me be clear. The use of starvation as a weapon of war is a war crime. All sides, including Syrian government, which has the primary responsibility to protect Syrians, are committing this and other atrocious acts prohibited under international humanitarian law.
Not only do the starvation tactics, it also makes it harder to fight things. Fatah al-Alab claimed that part of the reason for the failure to take al-Assad and Minyan during the counteroffensive in November was over 400 Russian airstrikes that were destroying any kind of advances that were being made by the rebel forces. Finally, the other major thing was the fact that they were outgunned. Several hundred reinforcements arrived in November and complemented the fact that the 1st Armored and 4th Mechanized Divisions were also deployed to Aleppo back in April. The new soldiers were fresh. They allowed them to take checkpoints over that were previously had to be guarded. With at least 12,000 soldiers to the rebels' 6,000, it made it hard for the rebels to kind of really put up any kind of counterfighting. The Syrian rebels were aware of all of these problems, but they weren't really able to come up with any successful solutions. They had tried to make a united front, but the last time that actually was able to happen was about 2 weeks before the collapse of Aleppo itself, with the army of Aleppo, and even then, it was way too little, way too late. The problem is the rebels as a whole have a wide array of ideologies, making it almost impossible to reconcile differences and form any kind of united front. There has currently been an attempt by the Idlib rebels to form under a single unified leadership, but that failed because Harar al-Sham has refused to participate. We'll talk about that later. If the rebel positions in Idlib are hoping to remain strong, it's going to rely on the rebels solving these issues, coming up with a united front, and finding some way to counter all the Syrian air power. It feels weird saying this, but the Battle of Aleppo is over now, and the new stage of the war has begun, with the battles going on in Idlib, with the battles going on in al-Bab, Raqqa, etc. Speaking of those, we're now going to move on to Palmyra. So, I asked capture Palmyra late 2016, as we reported in a previous podcast. In December, the SAA tried to launch a counterattack, but they really didn't get that far because ISIS just regrouped and recaptured the city. The big thing with Palmyra, though, is the T4 airbase and the oil fields beyond that. Heavy Russian, Syrian, and U.S. bombings, as well as reinforcements from the 800th Regiment paratroopers, managed to repel a series of IS offenses on that T4 airbase. Now, the airbase is no longer being used, so don't be worried about IS capturing airplanes. But it does hold a significant defensive position on the oil fields that are the last remaining productive oil fields the government has access to. Palmyra itself is a loss, but most of the goods and the history in Palmyra has already been destroyed in a previous battle.
Alongside the staggering death toll in Syria, history is paying a major price for the fighting in the country. Artifacts thousands of years old, destroyed by the Islamic State in the ancient city of Palmyra. But not all were destroyed. As Maya Margit explains, some are ending up in European and U.S. markets.
The big thing, though, is the oil fields. It is unlikely the government is going to retake Palmyra. And this has been postponed due to other battles going on in other regions. However, ISIS's attacks have also been postponed as they took a lot of casualties trying to take T4. And they also withdrew from a lot of their positions, seemingly as a way to try and counter the SDF push on Raqqa. And ISIS's growing offensive in Deir ez-Zor. Basically, Palmyra became not really worth the effort anymore for either side. Palmyra is likely to remain in controls of IS for the next several months, but it is also unlikely that IS will be able to launch any kind of sustained offensive towards the T4 base. On to Raqqa. Raqqa is the capital of the Islamic State, and pre-war had a population of about 200,000. The city has since become hit by airstrikes very regularly, and most non-Sunni structures in the city have been destroyed. A group inside the city, called Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently, has been publishing issues dealing with Raqqa on the internet in an attempt to spread the news about what's going on with them. The SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish-led coalition, has been launching an offensive towards Raqqa for the last about 3 months. On October 26th, the U.S. Secretary of Defense announced the beginning of the offensive.
I certainly am encouraged by the results of our campaign so far, in that it has been proceeding as planned. And today, we as members of the coalition resolve to follow through with that same sense of urgency and focus on enveloping and collapsing ISIL's control over Raqqa as well. In fact, we've already begun laying the groundwork with our partners to commence the isolation of Raqqa.
The SDF has been launching from their positions in the eastern part of Syria and pushing down into Raqqa from the north. The SDF launched the second phase of their offensive on the 10th of December with the aim of trying to capture all of the northwestern and western countryside, ultimately trying to secure the Tabqa Dam. The Tabqa Dam, also known as the Euphrates Dam, is 40 kilometers upstream from Raqqa. It's built during the Soviet era, and its construction led to the formation of Ligue Assad. It's currently controlled by IS, but IS lets the original staff man it because they're like, I don't know how this works. And because you don't want the dam to stop working, because then it overflows and there's a lot of people down there. Most of them are inside of Islamic State, and Islamic State's really trying to actually act as a political entity. Now, the strategic value of the dam itself is actually overrated. Regardless of who controls it, no one's going to turn it off or cut power to Raqqa. Islamic State won't do it for obvious reasons, because they control Raqqa, and that's not a good time. But the SDF won't do it either, because it will risk triggering a humanitarian crisis in Raqqa that they don't want to deal with, both for logistical reasons and PR reasons. So, what's the risk with taking it, I guess you're asking? The big thing, though, is the dam is symbolic, because it brings them a step closer to the capture of Raqqa, and it gives them a nice little PR spin, because the Syrian army failed to take this last year. Over the first 4 days of the offensive, the SDF captured like 20 villages, reaching the shores of Lake Assad, and besieging another 54 villages to the west. Now, with this response, blah, blah, blah. Over the first 4 days of the offensive, the SDF captured 20 more villages, reaching the shores of Lake Assad, cutting off another 50-something villages that IS held to the west. In response to this territory loss, IS began to carry out significant suicide attacks against the SDF and civilian targets in SDF-controlled regions. For the next 20 days, the SDF pushed hard and captured 97 villages and kind of cleaned up that western pocket, and began to advance toward Kailat Jabar. Now, Jabar is the main weapons storage and supply center for all of the IS villages to the northwest countryside, and its capture prevent the resupply of most of the IS fighters in that region. On December 21st, of 2016, the SDF seized those five villages, including Jabar. The Jabar fight was actually significantly harder than SDF intended, and the city was recaptured and captured three times over the next 4 days. In the battle that ranged, IS used four suicide attacks, but the SDF managed to maintain control of the city. By January the 1st, the SDF leadership had said they've captured 110 villages since the start of the second phase, and that they've captured 13 fighters. Over the next 3 weeks, the SDF has managed to secure all of the area around Tabqa Dam, and crucially, on the 25th of January, they entered the city of Tabqa itself. See, but the way they entered the city is actually kind of badass. So the way they crossed the dam is a single bridge, and giving access to the dam itself and the dam administration buildings. Otherwise, the lake and the river prevent access to the city. To get around this, the SDF and U.S. Special Forces had an amphibious landing where they crossed the river on barges. And as soon as they got to the south side of the river, they moved into the first quarter of the town and occupied it. During this attack, though, IS opened the dam turbines and releasing water downstream, flooding a lot of regions, which kind of forced the U.S. to kind of bunker down in their little region they've controlled. As of the 24th of January, the SDF and IS are currently locked in battle in the city. It is clear that IS is on the run near Raqqa. They've struggled to make any form of successful counterattacks and have completely failed to properly defend any major village despite years of time of preparation. In the end of January, IS began cracking down on inactivity, mostly due to fear that the news of their operational failures might spread to the citizenry. In this process, they formed a new internet police unit and began executing activists inside of Raqqa. So we're kind of getting a blackout of Raqqa news. But the big thing is, they're scared. The fact that they pulled back from the offensive in T4 is seen as a shift to defense of Raqqa. I don't believe the Kurdish will actually be allowed to capture the city, something we've seen in Mosul, but they will be able to take the countryside and begin to isolate it. Raqqa, like Mosul, is not going to be an easy battle. In Mosul, we've seen how slow that operation is going and how, even with heavy air support and U.S. special forces, there have been thousands of casualties and it's been really slow moving. But eventually, Raqqa will fall. On to the Battle of Mosul. The Battle of Mosul has been slow. This is mostly due to the fact that there was a large civilian population present in the city, and large amounts of IS resistance. Progress seemed to have stalled around the New Year's, however, this changed in the last 2 weeks as the majority of Islamic State lines in the eastern portion of the city collapsed. A lot of this collapse has come at quite the cost. The city has been liberated. A lot of this collapse has come at quite the cost to coalition members. As the city has been liberated, over 4,000 to 6,000 coalition troops have been killed, at the cost of only about 3,000 IS forces. The eastern portion of the city has been liberated as of January 27th, though.
The commander of Iraq's elite counterterrorism forces has announced the liberation of the eastern half of Mosul.
Today we celebrate the feast of victory and liberation, the liberation of East Mosul, the liberation of its soil and its good people.
The general says some Daesh terrorists remain holed up in the northeast of the city. A military official added that remnants of Daesh will be flushed out of those areas in the coming days. Baghdad says that it is now preparing for military operations to retake western Mosul, the last urban stronghold of Daesh in Iraq. In recent weeks, elite troops made swift advances against the Tekfiri group, retaking all important districts near the Tigris River, as well as all five bridges.
This was confirmed by Abadi, and this is huge. A lot of collapse was due to IS retreating to the west of the river, but that being said, this is a huge relief for those who were in the city and a huge relief for the government, who at the beginning of the year was worried that the siege was stalling. Mosul Eye has reported how the siege has been done in a very humanitarian way and really preserved the citizenry at the cost of basically nothing. Mosul Eye has reported that the siege has been going on in a very humanitarian manner. But this capture of the eastern portion of the city puts ISIS even further on the run. Mosul was their second largest city. The capture of the eastern portion of the city puts IS even more in a sticky situation. With Topkap Dam potentially falling, Al-Bab potentially falling, Raqqa beginning to come under siege, eastern half of Mosul falling, IS's positions have never been worse. And this is a key moment in this entire war, when IS is prone to completely collapse sometime in the next year. That being said, let's move on to Deir ez-Zor. Deir ez-Zor is currently one of the few remaining Syrian government strongholds in eastern Syria. In May 2015, though, Islamic State launched an offensive and cut off all of the supply routes to Deir ez-Zor. The city has been effectively under siege by ISIS ever since then, with supplies being delivered mostly by transport helicopters. IS began an offensive, though, on the 14th of January this year to attempt to retake the city. They've killed at least 12 soldiers and 2 civilians were killed in the very first day of the offensive. The aim, though, is to cut off the road between the airport and the city, because most of those supplies are coming into the airport. The SAA managed to launch a counterattack and repel ISIS as a threat there. ISIS, however, has continued its offensive and launched car bombs at checkpoints controlled by government forces, as well as shelling the Talat al-Brok district, which is one of the districts to the east of the city. They stormed and captured several other neighborhoods and the highway between the city and Damascus. IS also advanced along to capturing several strategic villages and a mountaintop overlooking the city. IS basically has kind of surrounded a large portion of the city itself and then began launching an offensive into the neighborhoods of the city. They split the government enclave in two on January the 16th, and heavy clashes have been reported around the cemetery as well as the main roundabout. The government has attempted to launch a counterattack, but IS has managed to continue its push forward and they captured several other neighborhoods as well as the city power plant, as in the process executing 10 captured SAA soldiers. On the 22nd of January, the army managed to finally begin to turn the tides and recapturing the southern front of the city as well as the main roundabout. At the current time, the city is split about 50-50. The fall of Deir ez-Zor would be an awkward situation for the government as it would lose one of the few remaining strongholds in the eastern portion of Syria, and as we've seen before, Islamic State is collapsing. It would be an awkward PR move to be the only front in which Islamic State is managing to actually continue its push on any portion of both Syria and Iraq. On to Al-Bab.
The fighting around Al-Bab in northern Syria has been described as some of the deadliest yet in Turkey's four-month-old Euphrates Shield operation against the Islamic State group. Turkey's military operation is focused on combating ISIL, but Ankara is also determined to prevent Kurdish militia from strengthening their presence along the Syrian border.
For the Kurdish, it is seen as vital for their goal to connect their cantons. A lot of Kurdish policy right now is to try and connect the Afrin canton in the west with the remaining cantons in the east. The main way to do this without having to go through government or Turkish-backed territory is through Al-Bab. For the last 3 months, the Turkish have been advancing on Al-Bab solely to try and capture the city before the Kurdish do. They managed to get there first, and they entered the city in late December. But they've been advancing so slowly. The rebels have managed to capture something around a third of the city. However, the advance has slowed as the TFSA has proved to be completely inept without the backing of the Turkish Air Force, and even fairly inept with the backing of the Turkish Air Force, and the Turkish Air Force has been limited due to the dangerousness of civilian casualties. At current time, over 90 Turkish fighters have been killed, 400 ISIS fighters have been killed in the last 3-ish weeks. However, we don't know the exact numbers as there's been mostly a media blackout on the region. However, after failing to penetrate Al-Bab from the north and west, because again, this offensive now has been going on for several months now, and they've managed to barely be able to penetrate the city, the rebels and Turkish forces started assaulting the city from the east. On January the 8th, they captured Adasa and Makri Hill. With these advances, they were basically trying to flank Al-Bab from the eastern portion. However, with this being said, the rebels did not suddenly get to be more skilled at fighting. And from the period of the 1st to the 14th of January, the rebels made 8 attempts to capture the village of Sultanaya, all of which were repelled. A local media activist claimed that the Syrian army has seen this ineptitude and has basically launched their own offensive to take Al-Bab, using the Kuwairis military airbase as a launch pad for their attacks. In the next week, the Syrian army captured 18 villages, advancing rapidly to the south of Al-Bab.
If government forces keep up with such rapid advances along the Aleppo-Al-Bab road, they will reach Turkish forces storming the ISIS stronghold of Al-Bab in northern Syria within a few days.
At the same time, the TFSA finally managed to capture the village of Sultanaya. However, they promptly lost it again and had to recapture it. It finally took them 3 weeks to capture a village with only several hundred occupants. The main problem is the TFSA is in a very bad position. The capture of Al-Bab puts the city and the TFSA surrounded Pinterest-style on three sides by either SDF or loyalists. This is because the SDF and SAA have made an alliance of convenience, and since the operation against the SDF last month, it's clear that they're very okay with capturing TFSA territory. There have been conflicting reports, though, that Turkey has said it is willing to hand over the siege of the city to the SAA. There were several internal people's reports coming out saying that they were, but then the deputy foreign minister said they weren't. It's not entirely clear. Erdogan came out 2 days ago and said that Al-Bab is the only city they're going to capture and then the TFSA is going to call it quits. But he said this a lot. It's unclear what he actually means. Either way, though, if Al-Bab is handed over to the SAA, this is the end for the TFSA. The Turkish Free Syrian Army's entire reason for existence is the capture of Al-Bab. Now, an agreement where the SAA takes control of the city seems perfectly reasonable because the Turkish main goal is that the Kurdish do not control the city. If this happens, it seems the SDF will still try and connect the cantons, not through Al-Bab, however, through Kabasin.
Ya جاءكم من قوة ومن رباط الخيل ترهبون به عدو الله وعدوكم.
أعدوا ما استطعتم أرهبوهم أقيموا الحرب حيث ثقفتموها خذوهم واحصروهم واقتلوهم يعذبهم وينصركم عليها ويشفي صدور قوم مؤمنين.
خذوا تربا من الأرض احفنوه وحثوا واهتفوا شاهد وجوه.
That was the sound of Harar al-Sham's recruitment video. Harar al-Sham. Harar al-Sham, which translates to the Islamic movement of the Free Men of the Levant, is a Sunni Salafist militant group operating in Syria that aims to replace the Assad regime with some kind of a Islamic government. Think Sunni Iran. It was founded by Hassan Aboud and former prisoners of the Assad in late 2011. The group was initially based in the Idlib government, but has quickly expanded throughout most of Syria. Since 2012, Harar al-Sham has primarily coordinated attacks against the Syrian army with Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, formerly al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate. The groups became prominent by pioneering using IEDs, as well as targeting military bases in order to capture weapons. The U.S. Director of National Intelligence considers Harar al-Sham to be one of the most effective Syrian opposition groups, and they led the formation of the Syrian Islamic Front in 2012, which then morphed into the Islamic Front in 2013, which was one of the first and largest Syrian umbrella groups, with about 40,000 to 70,000 fighters. Now, as what happens with most Syrian umbrella groups, this then, you know, kind of fell apart. But instead of the groups completely collapsing, Harar al-Sham kind of absorbed most of those fighters from the smaller factions into their main organization. Harar al-Sham actually worked with the Islamic State until January 2014, when Islamic State killed an Harar al-Sham fighter after the group's leader criticized Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Harar al-Sham initially was one of the more hardline rebel groups and was willing to work with other radical groups. However, after a series of smaller skirmishes, including Jabhat al-Nusra, they began to target IS and drove them out of the city of Raqqa in January 6, 2014. Back it up. Harar al-Sham actually worked with January 2014, when Islamic State killed a Harar al-Sham fighter after Harar al-Sham rejected Abu Bakr's attempts to. Harar al-Sham actually worked with the Islamic State until January 2014, when there was a kind of breakdown in relations after Islamic State killed an Harar al-Sham fighter. Islamic State killed the fighter because Harar al-Sham criticized al-Baghdadi. It was a mess. But the big reason is Harar al-Sham actually initially was one of the more hardline rebel groups and was willing to work with other radicals like Islamic State. However, the kind of breakdown relations between Islamic State and the hardline groups that were not Islamic State, think Jabhat al-Nusra and Harar al-Sham, this kind of broke down. Islamic State kicked Harar al-Sham's founders out of Raqqa and then killed most of them in a car bomb attack. Harar al-Sham then elected a new leader, Abu Yahya al-Hamawi, and he has taken the organization down a much more moderate path, focusing on attempting to get Western recognition and support. The group began to publish a series of op-ed pieces in Western papers presenting themselves as the moderate opposition. Although they have actually very little change to their belief structure, they still want to form a Sunni Salafist state in Syria. They are presenting themselves as moderate in an attempt to get Western support. Here is a clip where he explains himself and what he wants from his organization.
إرهابيون قريبون من تنظيم القاعدة. أنا أتحدث عن بداية تأسيس الكتائب يعني كتائب أحرار الشام تحديدا. فهل هي نتاج هذه البرامج التدريبية الفكرية ولا إيديولوجية؟
والله يا أخي لا شك.
Harar al-Sham under al-Hamawi recovered and in 2015 began to regularly clash with both the government and Islamic State. It created Jaish al-Fatah, or the Army of Conquest, which successfully pushed the government out of Idlib. As a result of the Army of Conquest victory, Turkey and Saudi Arabia began to fund Harar al-Sham. They basically became the primary moderate rebel group. In addition, it's also played a really big role in the negotiation of ceasefires. Harar al-Sham initially opposed negotiations with the Assad regime because, as a member of the Islamic coalition, they wanted only groups run by... In addition to its combat stuff, Ahrar al-Sham has also played a really big role in like ceasefire negotiation. They eventually agreed to the first Syrian ceasefire with the army and Hezbollah in August 2012. In addition to its combat operations, Ahrar al-Sham played a crucial role in negotiating ceasefires with the Assad regime in 2015. They first signed a first ceasefire with Hezbollah and the Syrian army in August 12th, 2015. And there was a 24 to 48 hour cessation of hostilities in Zabadani and Kefreya. This was a part of this whole image they're trying to cultivate of being negotiable and moderate. The ceasefire was brokered by Turkey, who represented Ahrar al-Sham, and as well as Iran, who was acting in behalf of the Assad regime. But it was a big population exchange that expelled Shiites from Idlib and allowed Sunni militants to return to the province. But the big key here was not the actual outcomes of the ceasefire, it was this presenting a moderate front. In December 2015, Ahrar withdrew from peace talks that were being hosted by Saudi Arabia after concerns that Saudi Arabia kind of wanted the conflict to end and was willing to compromise too much with Assad. Ahrar al-Sham itself, though, now is going through a pretty significant internal crisis, which might have significant impacts both on the group but on the entire dynamic of the Syrian conflict. Most of this has to do with this presenting a moderate front. The movement's leaders peaked on the 10th of December when 16 local factions formed a new sub-faction known as Jaish al-Ahrar under the leadership of Ahrar al-Sham's former chief, Hashim al-Sheikh. The more pragmatic cadre wanted to turn the movement into a more politically accepted Islamic group by distancing themselves from the Salafi jihadi puritanism, kind of working a lot less with Jaish Fateh al-Sham and negotiating more with the government and the Western coalition partners. The hardliner current within Ahrar al-Sham wants to embrace that Salafi jihadi puritanism and wants to merge with other groups like Jaish Fateh al-Sham. We talked about before when we looked at the reasons why Aleppo failed, it was this disunity between the rebels, and the rebels are aware of this. And the hardline elements think the solution to this is to unify with all the groups, including the radical groups like Jaish Fateh al-Sham. They also want to distance themselves from Turkey, the West, and the other Syrian allies, mostly because they don't like the outside interference in the war. Now, this has been a problem in Ahrar al-Sham since the very beginning. And now, usually when this happens, they have the election, whoever receives the majority of the support takes the lead, and everyone kind of falls into line under them, mostly kind of grumbling. However, this election of a new leader in November was the last straw and kind of divided the group massively. Usually the group's leader is elected by the majority of the Shura Council's 22 members and then rules for a year. Regardless of how and when the group's infighting is resolved, it will like... Usually the group's leader is elected by the majority of the Shura Council's 22 members and then rules for a year. Although Ali Omar, who serves as the group's current leader, received the majority of the votes, several hardliners protested against his election. Now, eight of the members then suspended their membership, explaining that their decisions resulted from the deadlock and solving the problems of the movement. They refused to accept anyone else other than the candidates they have proposed, either the former leader of the movement, Hashim al-Sheikh, or the military commander, Abu Salah Tan. This is unprecedented behavior, because the hardliners are accusing the pragmatists of siding against the more hardline elements of the group in order to make it more regionally and internationally acceptable, and thus are trying to change the group's core identity. Remember, the group did start out as a hardline Salafist group, and the hardliners that have been there since the beginning don't like these newcomers coming in and kind of trying to change the direction, the core identity of Ahrar al-Sham. A lot of this also culminated around merger talks with Jaish Fateh al-Sham. Those talks came to a head on December 22nd when Ahrar al-Sham's council voted no, surprise, surprise, on the merger. This was after extensive negotiations, and Zinki had been brought into the fold as well as others. And an Al-Qaeda insider said that Ahrar al-Sham was initially going to agree to join, but wanted other groups to join as well and make it a more moderate flair. However, Jaish Fateh al-Sham wanted Ahrar al-Sham to join first, and then they can do other negotiations later. This caused the talks to break down, and the no vote was cast. Honestly, I think this is the right decision for them to make. If Ahrar wants to appear moderate enough for Western support, they cannot cooperate with Jaish Fateh al-Sham. If the end goal for Ahrar is now a peace settlement, cooperation with Jaish Fateh al-Sham means there will be no peace. But if they currently maintain their moderate position, there is a chance they will be left with some control, their heads, or something, in a peace settlement. Honestly, it is very unlikely now that the Syrian rebels will win this war. Their best bet is some kind of peace deal, and if Haftar al-Sham wants to be a part of that, they need to continue this perception of modernism. It's the only way for them to go to the table with some kind of cards to actually play. It is clear the moderate rebels alone are not enough to defeat Assad, and if the rebels want to put up an effective resistance against Assad, they will need to unify, but in unifying, they will destroy any chance they have in negotiation. It's this awkward double bind, and there's nothing they can do about it. Thank you for listening to the Syrian Civil War podcast. We will be back next Sunday with the next episode. This one will be looking at the siege of Kobani back 2 years ago. We want to thank Dan Cullen for our music and Nodemeyer for our transitions. Please check out our website, SyrianCivilWarPodcast.wordpress.com. Thank you and have a great week.